Moncrief on News Talk.
Sponsored by 123.ie. Don't make insurance a hot topic. Just go to 123.ie, where simple is smarter.
You may be aware of the Netflix documentary and forthcoming movie about the American serial killer Ted Bundy. Bundy was executed in 1989 after he confessed to the murder of 30 women, but it's widely thought that he killed more than that, which makes Kathy Kleener's story all the more exceptional. While in her dorm room at university, she survived a vicious attack by Bundy. He'd already murdered two women that night in the same university. Kathy, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Not too bad. Now, I'd like to start, if that's okay, not with your encounter with Ted Bundy, but your life after that. Because, obviously that was traumatic enough, but you were left in a situation where your jaw was wired shut, and I suppose you didn't really know what to do next. What did you do next?
After the attack, I went to the hospital in Tallahassee, and my jaw was broken, so they wired my mouth shut, and I had almost bitten my tongue off, but you can't stitch your tongue, so it actually had to heal with time.
So did you have to be fed through a tube, or how did you eat?
Yes, actually my teeth were kind of shattered or moved around during the attack, since he did attack my face so hard. I actually, when I went home to Miami, where I lived at the time from FSU, my sister and parents were there, and my sister used to make me like cream of wheat with real runny with like garlic in it one time. And then she'd make it with broccoli, and she made it one time with asparagus, and anything I could suck through the straw that went through the spaces in my teeth was all of nourishment I could get in. And I remember when she made the broccoli and cream of wheat, I'm like, no, I'm never eating that again. Don't do that. So there were certain things she'd make that I just wouldn't eat.
Yeah. And how long was it then before the jaw was unwired and you could use it again?
My jaw was wired in Tallahassee right after the night of the attack. I then returned to Miami, where a couple weeks later I saw an oral surgeon. And he had to re-break the jaw again because it was not lined correctly in Tallahassee. So when he re-broke my jaw in three places, under the ears and under the chin, he put wires and screws in the bone to maintain a steady way for my mouth to heal. That's when I was trying to eat after that surgery.
Oh.
I had my jaw wired the second time.
Oh, my
God.
That's
when I was trying to eat through a straw.
And this is obviously at home with your family. And during that period, did you talk about should you go back to university or what should you do with your life?
After the attack at FSU in 78, I did go home and was recuperating. And my emotional fears had to heal as well as my physical. And one of the things when I was, my mouth was unwired, I went to work at a lumber yard in Miami because I was afraid of men. I didn't know at that point who attacked me, who was he coming back, who was it, are all men evil? So I went and worked in the lumber yard until I felt like, okay, I'm okay. These guys, you know, I'm over this. And so I left the lumber yard at that point because I felt like I was healed from that feeling of being scared.
Was it just after that then you got a job in a bank?
Yes. After my wires were removed and I worked at the lumberyard, I then got a job in a bank as a bank teller. And one day I was at my window where it said, you know, next teller, please. This gentleman came up to my window and he had like a little bag with him. That he was carrying, and he put a note to my window and said, give me all your money, I have a gun, and I will use it. So I'm standing there going, oh my goodness, my knees are knocking, and I thought, oh no. So he showed me the gun, he opened the pouch a little bit and showed me the gun. So I started thinking, do I give him the ones first or the 20s first? We weren't kind of taught how to do that in classes there. So while I'm talking to him, he sees behind me the drive-through window that the police officer had driven in because he was called as a possible robbery. So when he was in behind me at the drive-thru, the gentleman with the gun was in front of me. So he saw the cop and ran out the door, and I'm going, yeah, take that. Because I don't know why he ran. Yeah. And the police were there, and actual, you know, halt or I'll shoot. And the, there were gunshots and everything, and it was like, whoa, this is intense.
Yeah.
So I kind of stopped working then as a teller and worked on the other side of the bank as a savings counselor because I thought it was a lot safer.
Yeah. Well, understandably, and no one would blame you for that at all. After that, what was the time gap between you being attacked and then testifying at Ted Bundy's trial?
It was just over a year, I believe. The first time I encountered Ted was right after the attack, and I was healing in Miami. They took me back to Tallahassee and did the grand jury, where I had to go in and answer questions from both the prosecution and the defense side. It was a long conference table. At the other end sat Bundy. So I was on one side of the table, head of the table, looking at him, and he was on the other side looking at me. I did not take my eyes off of him. I stared at him. I answered all their questions while I kept my eyes open and on him. And it was, you know, I wanted to get over that I couldn't see him and it was scary. And I also wanted to know that he didn't win, that I wasn't going to back down. So that was the second time, the first time I really sat there and watched him. And then during the trial, they in Miami, they had the witnesses all in one room because we are not allowed to be in the courtroom and hear everyone's testimony. So we were all in one room. There was Karen Chandler. There were a lot of sorority sisters. There were the paramedics that took care of me that night. And I remember talking to them and hugging them and, you know, thanking them for saving my life. And they said, you know, when we first got to you, we thought you had been shot in the face because your face was so badly mutilated from being attacked. So when it was my turn to go into the witness box, I sat there and the prosecution asked me a lot of questions. And then the defense came up and asked me one question. And Bundy again was sitting at the defense table looking at me and I was staring at him. And the question was, did you see this man attacking you that night in Chi Omega? And I was, no, I could not see his face. The room was dark, and therefore all I saw was a shadow. Mm-hmm. So that they said, okay, that's the only question we had. And I felt so defeated. It's like, no, I wanted to tell more about it, but that was the only question they asked. Because again, I couldn't see his face.
And it was, now, obviously, from what you have told us, you were determined that this wasn't going to affect the rest of your life, that you were going to get on with your life and all that kind of stuff, which must have been very difficult to do. And it was another decade, as I understand it, before he was executed. When he was finally executed, that day, did you, if you like, allow yourself an emotional response to that?
Yes, we got a call from the district attorney in Tallahassee that there were no more stays on his life. Let me back up and tell you that over the years after he was caught and put through the judicial system that he was actually going to die, he had a death sentence. Over the years, there were judges over the country who would give him a stay of execution. And that meant that he had longer for the defense to come up with an appeal or whatever it was that he got a stay for. That used to hurt so bad because Lisa and Margaret did not have a stay. They did not get to continue their life until there was another time where a judge didn't say, okay, it's time. And I always felt that these judges that gave him a stay, if they had a daughter, I wish they had let their daughter go out with Ted Bundy if they thought that he was so good and deserved not to die. So at that point, it was it was okay that he was going to be electrocuted. It felt good, and I wanted it to happen. And actually, the morning that it happened, the district attorney called us, and this is before you saw it on the news, and said that he had been electrocuted and that he was dead. I remember sitting on the sofa with my fiancé and crying, and I wailed. I just cried, and I got it all out of my system. And my fiancé was like, "Are you okay?" I said, "Yes." I took a deep breath, and I said, "Okay, let's go to breakfast now." So that's the way I dealt with the actual execution.
Yeah. Since that time, you sound like a very, very positive person. And you know, part of the reason we're talking to you is because, you know, there was a Netflix documentary and there's a Zac Efron movie. Do you have a problem with any of that? Because one could say that these things are slightly glorifying him in that they seem to stress on how good looking he was and how charming he was and all that kind of thing.
Yes. I think I have not seen the movie yet. It's not out, but I watched all 4 hours of the tapes from Netflix. I just sat down and watched all 4 hours. And that movie portrayed, or that those tapings portrayed how he wanted to be seen. So to say he was glorified and made to look like a pretty boy, yeah, he was, because that's what he wanted us to see. And as the tapes went on, you got to see more and more of his personality that he couldn't hide anymore, that actually was coming out. And that was the demented side of him, the side that was evil. And I believe he couldn't control himself when he made that that switch from darling Bundy to evil Bundy. Yeah. And as far as the shows go, I found it very therapeutic that I talk and I read and I watch every show that was made about him right after the attack. And I felt that helped me heal, because that gave a personality to the person that attacked me instead of a big, bad shadow.
Yeah.
I could put something in front of me and know it and read it. And it really helped make it so I was stepping away one step at a time from the incident, from the attack. And every step I took, I got better and better, until he just wasn't part of my life anymore. I don't want to be thought of as a survivor. I have lupus, and I've had breast cancer, and I survived the breast cancer. So I am a survivor, but it's because I was thriving in my life that I could proceed and take care of the other things that I had to go through.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because to go back to the night of the original attack, and to just explain to the listeners, Karen Chandler, that Kathy referred to, that was Kathy's roommate. He'd already killed two women and the two of you had a habit of keeping your curtains open and lights shined in the window. Well, God knows what would have happened.
Oh. I believe he would have gone room to room. It was a small hallway with rooms on each side, maybe about 8-10 rooms on each side. And I believe he would have just walked room to room and continue attacking. I think he was in a frenzy and known he had already killed two and attacked two. And I think he would just kept going. Yeah. After he attacked Karen Chandler, my roommate, he came back to my side of the bed, on my side of the room, and attacked me again, because Bundy didn't leave any survivors.
Yeah.
So he was trying to kill me because I was laying in bed moaning and groaning, and he knew I wasn't dead yet. So when the light shone up in our room from someone was bringing home their date that was a Kayo, the light shone up in our room, and he thought he was seen. And at that point, he left our room and went down the front staircase to go out the front door. And that's when one of the sorority sisters was coming home from her date. She saw him from the side view, and thank God he didn't see her.
Yeah.
So after the attack, she went upstairs, and there was someone in the bathroom. And this is like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And she said someone was just running down the stairs, and they went and looked. And at that point, Karen Chandler walked out into the hallway and met the two sisters standing in the hallway. And she was her jaw was broken. Her mouth was just a mess. she had been had lacerations on her head as well. And they brought her in, back into our room, and they saw me, and that's when they called 911, still not knowing exactly what happened.
Yeah.
But that started the process of being helped.
Do you stay in contact with Karen?
No, I do not. I think we shared this together, and then I think we moved on with our lives. It wasn't something that we needed to revisit,
mm-hmm.
and I think seeing each other might have caused that feeling again to resurface. As far as I was concerned, I could read anything and see anything, but I don't know. I think talking with Karen would have been a little bit more too close to that night and being attacked.
Yeah, that's very understandable. Kathy, thank you so much for speaking with us today. Kathy Kleiner, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day.